accept or reject GMOs? Genetically modified organisms that are found in a wide variety of the foods we eat. Are they safe for us and the environment? Will they save the world from starvation or lead to its ruin? Are the benefits hyped? Are the dangers downplayed? What's the lowdown? Our guest decided to investigate so we could better understand the issues in this long-running debate and make better informed choices when we buy food. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to The Ideas Network. It is coming up on 9 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, January 24th. So what are your concerns with genetically modified foods, or are you fine with them? Join in with your questions and thoughts at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us McKay Jenkins, the Cornelius Tillman Professor of English Journalism and Environmental Humanities at the University of Delaware. He is the author of several books, including Contamination, The Last Ridge, and his latest, which is just out today, Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So define a GMO. What exactly is a GMO?
Good question. GMO stands for, as you mentioned earlier, a genetically modified organism. And what this in general practice means is plants that are altered somehow in their genetic makeup. So scientists have figured out how to get into a plant's genome and take a piece from another organism's genome and put it into the plant so that it could, for example, make it resistant to an herbicide or make the plant better equipped to grow in a drought or make it, have nutrients that it might not otherwise have. So it's a very interesting scientific technique that allows scientists to take a plant and alter it in one way or another. Now, I'm sure we'll talk about this, but there are many ways that that can manifest. It can turn into really beneficial things that some people are very fond of, and it can turn into a lot of other things that people are much more concerned about.
Yeah. This has been going on for a long time. I mean, aren't genetically modified organisms or genetically modified foods, haven't they been on our store shelves for a very long time?
They have, and what I found interesting about this, and one of the reasons I wanted to write about it, is because they are absolutely everywhere, and at the same time, they seem to be almost completely invisible. So when someone goes into a supermarket and they would like to avoid GMOs, they aren't even really sure where to look to avoid them. So, for example, most people think that all GMOs must show up, since they're plants, after all, they must show up only in the fruits and vegetables aisle. But the truth is there are virtually no GMOs in the fruit and vegetable aisle. The only place in an American supermarket that you find GMOs is in the famous center of the supermarket, where you have all your processed foods, all your soda, all your snack foods, all that sort of thing. And people don't understand that. They think, well, it's a genetically altered plant, so why wouldn't they be in the produce section? And the answer for that is that the only GMOs that really enter our diet are through two or three grains, primarily corn and soybeans, which are manufactured at this unimaginable quantities in the United States and then turned into a vast array of food products, not the fresh foods, but the processed foods, the snack foods, the soft drinks, the fast food hamburgers. One thing we should talk about really is how much of the meat that we consume in the country is fed GMO grains, whether you're talking about chickens or hogs or beef cattle. They are all fed GMOs, and I think we eat something on the order of 9 billion animals a year. So we're getting a main line of GMO crops through the meat that we eat. So one thing to think about, and maybe we could talk some more about this, is where to look for them and where you will, despite what you might suppose, where you probably won't find them.
Well, and we will. But if the corn and soybeans are genetically modified and then that's put into all these various processed foods or the fresh meats, because the animals eat the grain. Why is the corn I buy in the fresh produce aisle genetically modified?
Well, most of the corn that you eat most likely is not genetically modified, at least in my part of the world. I live in Baltimore, and on the East Coast, most of what we eat, what humans eat here is, you know, the famous New Jersey sweet corn, for example, which is typically not GMO. The corn that is made for humans is just a different kind of corn. The corn that we're talking about that is GMO and planted on tens of millions of acres around the Midwest is mostly feed corn for cattle, or it's made for, you know, ethanol, gasoline production, or it's made for, like I said, for these processed foods.
And the same goes for the soybeans. But for example, I eat a lot of tofu. Does that mean I'm eating a lot of GMOs?
Well, see, that's very interesting. I actually spent some time interviewing a farmer on the eastern shore of Maryland about this, and she grows several different kinds of soybeans. She grows GMO soybeans for the feed market, and she grows non-GMO soybeans for the tofu market. And part of the reason for that is that Asia, I mean, one thing we'll talk about later is how the rest of the world feels about GMOs. And Asia is very, much of Asia is very anti-GMO, just like most of Europe is anti-GMO. So if an American farmer is growing soybeans for the Asian tofu market, they absolutely can't contaminate the non-GMO soybeans with the GMO soybeans, or the Asian market won't buy it. And they're very strict about that and very upset when that stuff gets cross-contaminated. So generally speaking, the tofu that you eat is probably going to be from non-GMO soybeans.
All right. So what is the big to-do over GMO corn or soybeans being put into the crackers I eat? How is that really dangerous?
Well, one of the first lines in my book is something along the lines of the first question, and sometimes the only question people want to know is, are GMOs bad for me? And that's the wrong question. So there is a lot of debate about whether genetically altered organisms are somehow dangerous for our health. And there are lots and lots of people, in fact, the vast majority of scientists, say that GMOs are absolutely not a problem for human health. Now, there are absolutely also some very credible scientists that say, we're not so sure about that. In fact, this technology has been around only for about 25 years, and a lot of the studies that ought to be done and someday will be done haven't yet been done. After all, introducing a brand new food product into the human digestive system, that normally happens in evolutionary time. You grow through evolution to be used to eating this and not that, or growing a resistance to this or not that. So these new foods really in the grand scheme of things have only been around for a pretty short time. So it's important to say that big scientific organizations have said very formally that GMOs are not a problem for human health. It's important to say that there are also a number of dissenting scientists who say we're not so sure. And then there's a whole other category of people that say, there are certain things that we've become quite used to, things like digestive disorders, like, for example, celiac disease or gluten intolerance. And the question is, are these because the plants have been modified, or is this because of the herbicides that have been sprayed on some of these crops? And there's some thought, as I'm sure you've heard the term Roundup, this very common herbicide that you can buy in any hardware store, is used in all kinds of farming all over the world, is the most common herbicide in the world. There are people that say, you know, it may be that people's digestive systems are actually responding negatively to the use of these chemicals, which are sprayed on GMOs. So in other words, maybe some of our GI disorders are not caused by GMOs, they're caused by the herbicides that are sprayed on the GMOs.
Yeah. So we only have a minute before a news break, and then we have lots more time to talk after that. But I thought part of the point, as you mentioned when we first started, part of the point of having GMOs in our foods, that it made them more resistant to pests, and that this would mean that we don't have to use as many herbicides or pesticides on our crops.
Well, that's a good point. So it makes the crop resistant to the pests, but you spray the crop to get rid of the pests. So the crop is being sprayed with these herbicides. So what these chemicals are meant to do is to kill everything else except for the crop that you're harvesting. So, for example, if you're growing corn, you spray it with something that will kill all the other weeds, but not the corn. Then you harvest the corn, bring it to market. The corn now has been grown with all these herbicides, so it's not like we're using less. It's that the herbicides are now being applied to the foods that actually end up in our system. We can talk about all the negative resulting consequences, like killing all those other weeds has meant, for example, the killing of all milkweed, which is the primary food for monarch butterflies, and monarch butterfly populations, as I'm sure you know, are something at 4% of their normal population. So we've seen a crash in butterflies that is a direct result of the use of all these chemicals on all these big crops.
We are talking with McKay Jenkins. He is the author of the brand new book, Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. So what questions do you have for him? What concerns do you have, if any, about GMOs? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll check news and then we'll be back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with the author of the new book, Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. McKay Jenkins is our guest, and we welcome your questions for him about GMOs and the future of GMOs and what this means for what we eat. Coming up, we will talk more about how we can make better choices in the supermarket if we are concerned about our foods containing GMOs. And on the GMO food front, a new Apple is expected to hit supermarket shelves soon. There is a Midwestern grocery stores could see this new apple as early as February 1st. It's an apple that has been genetically modified so it does not turn brown. And we will wonder if you would eat an apple like this or not. And we'll ask our guest about this. But first, let's take some calls. Daniel in Nasita is with us. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Yes. What is your concern or question?
Well, I am against GMOs for the most part. A few different reasons. One is they're gene dominant or tend to be gene dominant, meaning that they take over the gene line when they cross-pollinate with other species, including in animals. There's also GMO salmon that was created. That will be on markets. I'm not sure when. I can't remember. And then I wanted to point out with the overuse of pesticides that they're able to do with GMOs now, that's also a part of the problem killing the bee population. And I know Wisconsin loves their outdoors and their gardening and growing their gardens. So, I mean, that's just another thing. But I really appreciate the guest you have on. I was really surprised that this wasn't a puff piece on GMOs. Thank you.
Well, I don't know why you were surprised at that, but so let's talk about all these issues. Do GMOs in the pesticide use for these crops, is that killing our bee population too, McKay?
Well, I'm so glad that your caller asked. He asked two questions, really, one about the GMO salmon and one about the what are called neonicotinoid pesticides that are used that end up killing bees. So let me see if I can take each question. So that he's absolutely right about both of those things. So the idea that you can create a genetically modified fish, now this is the whole new horizon, is not just genetically altered plants, but genetically altered animals. And the worry about these fish is that if somehow genetically altered salmon get released into the wild, that is to say into the oceans, and start to crossbreed, or as he mentions, just simply outcompete native salmon, you could have major disruptions to not just the food chain for human consumption, but for ecological webs that are vastly more complex than most of us ever understand. This is also true with the bees. So again, companies didn't set out to kill bees. They set out to create a chemical that would kill insects that farmers don't want. But one of the unintended consequences was the destruction of bee populations, what we called bee colony collapse disorder. So beekeepers around the country are really in a state of crisis about this. Now, Maryland, where I live, I think is the first state in the country to actually ban these neonic pesticides because of the damage that they've been doing to bees. Now, if you only think practically, if you only think about human food, which I think is a very limited way to think about it, but even if you only think about human food, you have to keep in mind that bees pollinate something like 30% of all the food that humans eat. 30%. So one-third of all the food we eat depends on bees, not on anything else, on bees. If the bees go away, we're not going to eat. So if you only think about bees as helping humans eat, we still need to protect them. But the larger question really is about not just about humans, it's about the entire natural state of things, the whole ecological web. You saw this 30 or 40 years ago when we had DDT being sprayed on everything. Now, the intention was to kill insects, but the net result is we almost made the bald eagle, our national symbol, go extinct because the DDT was getting into the food web, ended up in the bodies of bald eagles. They would sit on their eggs, the eggs would crack, and there goes the whole bald eagle population. We banned DDT, and now bald eagles are so common where I live on the Chesapeake Bay that they're actually becoming a nuisance. So a single chemical in this case made or broke an entire population of major apex predator birds. So we really have to be aware not just about human food, but about the way all of these things fit together in the food chain and the ecological webs around us.
If you can explain in a way I can understand what our caller meant when he said that the gene dominant issue that he brought up.
Well, the whole point of doing this gene manipulation is to make organisms that are more powerful in one way or another than they normally would be. So, for example, you make a corn plant that can stand up to an absolute assault of chemicals that kill everything else. So it's it is more dominant in that world than all the other versions of itself that are not genetically altered. If you make, there are scientists out there now that are trying to make plants that are more photosynthetically efficient. In other words, plants that could take sunlight and turn it even more efficiently into sugars and therefore calories. And that sounds like a great idea, right? You could grow more calories per acre. The problem is that are what are known as cascading effects that we don't know. So if a plant is now getting, you know, Herculean in its capacity to create energy, what is it that same plant is going to suck that much more nutrients out of the soil? It's going to suck that much more water out of the ground, and suddenly you're going to have these unpredictable problems of soil depletion, water depletion. So just because you can make a Hercules plant or a Hercules animal doesn't mean that that thing is going to exist independently of everything else. Everything is connected. So the technology enthusiasts out there love to create a brand new product, but they don't always consider the downstream effects of all the things they do. That's why I'm saying that whether or not a GMO causes you to get sick or not is really not the most important question. The most important question is how do these foods fit into the much larger question of how we eat, how we view our land, how we view our water, all that kind of thing.
Don in Appleton is with us. Hello, Don.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Now, I kind of got a little off-topic question. I raised heirloom plants and vegetables in my garden, and I strayed away from GMOs simply because I heard that about 10-20% of my plants I let go to seed so I can replant them next year. Now, I heard that GMOs, when you bring them to seed, won't reproduce the same as, you know, every other heirloom plant or every other plant out there. Basically, they just don't continue on. So for long-term sustainability, I haven't grown them. Now, is that a fact where you can't really bring in the seed, where they won't produce the same kind of plant or anything? I'm wondering what your guess knows about that.
That's a very interesting question. Now, as far as I am aware, there are no GMO tomatoes. So if you're talking about growing heirloom fruits and vegetables, unless there are a very small handful. One of them is the GMO papaya, which is grown in Hawaii, which is a fruit that you can find in the supermarket, and they're GMO papaya and they're non-GMO papaya. The non-GMO papaya farmers are concerned about what you mentioned, like the cross-pollination, for one thing. Like, would their plants be cross-pollinated with a GMO? And that makes them nervous because there are consumers that don't want GMO and they are worried about the cross-pollination. The other thing, though, if we get away from the fruits and vegetables, is really the question of seeds for these large monoculture crops. And the concern here for most people is that the companies that sell farmers genetically altered seeds, along with the pesticides to go with them, require that they buy these seeds year after year after year. In other words, the ancient practice of farmers trading seeds, growing seeds, you know, hybridizing seeds, coming up with the best version of seeds, and then trading them with each other is no longer possible because these seeds are patented, owned, that is to say, their genes are owned by the companies that design them, and there's a lot of concern that this is too intrusive into the lives of farmers, that the ancient practice of trading seeds is now technically illegal because if farmer A buys GMO seeds and then trades them to farmer B, but B didn't pay the company, that B is somehow infringing on the patent of the company. So this is another major concern that I get into in the book, which is the kind of corporate control of ancient farming practices, including something as benign as the trading of seeds. So your question really gets into a lot of very complicated issues.
Thank you, Don, for that. You mentioned that you're not aware of a genetically modified a tomato that's out there. That's what brought this to a lot of people's attention, though, is when they tried to, you start the book with the Flavor Saver. It was, tell us about the Flavor Saver tomato.
Well, the Flavor Saver, which for those of you who are language fans, it's spelled F-L-A-V-R-S-A-V-R, which is kind of a copyrighted trademark name for the first GMO product that was released out onto the market in the early 1990s. And that tomato was basically designed to be an industrial tomato. So I'm sure you know this, when you buy a banana right now, almost anywhere in the United States or most of the non-tropical world, there's only one kind of banana that you can buy.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Cavendish banana. And the reason for that is because you can pick it green and you can ship it with a thick skin and it will arrive and it will ripen in the market and not be bruised. Most other kinds of bananas are not shippable because they're not tough. The Flavor Saver tomato was designed for the same reasons. You pick it, it ripens slowly, it's got a thick skin, and it will survive the industrial harvesting and shipping of tomatoes all over the country. Now, it turned out that it tasted terrible and nobody liked it. So even though it was genetically modified and it was approved by the FDA and everything else, it was not a commercial success. And it basically was discontinued because it didn't taste good. And that the reason I like that story is because, you know, you don't want to buy a tomato in New Jersey that is grown in Oklahoma and shipped all the way across the country just because it can be shipped. What you want to do is buy a nice, ripe New Jersey tomato in New Jersey that is picked ripe and you eat it the next day or 2 days later and it's ripe and it's fresh and preferably organic. In other words, you want to eat locally. You want to eat from farmers that you know. You don't want to be eating these kind of plastic products that are being shipped all over the world just because a scientist knows how to design them.
Yeah, I want to eat one of Don's heirloom tomatoes.
Exactly.
What about this apple that I'm reading about? In fact, you were interviewed for a piece that I just saw online, that this genetically engineered apple, the Arctic apple, which whatever was done to it, it will not brown. Supposed to hit grocery stores as early as February 1st. Is that going to go the same way as the Flavor Saver, or what do you think?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if people are going to accept it or not. And that question is really the major question here. We've all been operating so far this morning on the assumption that most people think that GMOs are somehow bad. They don't know really why. They're not sure. They just sort of have heard, or they have this gut instinct that GMOs are something to be avoided. This is a big problem for the companies that make GMOs, because if the general popular taste turns against GMOs, it won't just be fruits and vegetables. They will start rejecting anything that's made with GMO. And that if they reject everything, is going to mean all fast food, all processed food, all soda pop, all everything, all that stuff we talked about earlier. So the industrial food producers of the world are desperately trying to find a GMO product that everybody's going to love. Because if they love the GMO apple, then the GMO name will suddenly be a happy, sunny name instead of the dark and threatening name that it is now. So if they can say, look, everybody loves the Arctic apple. See, GMOs aren't that bad. Then suddenly everyone will be talking about GMOs in a different kind of way, and nobody will resist them. Nobody will be demanding labels for them, and it'll be a PR bonanza. So really, in my view, this is really not about the apple. People may or may not buy it. I don't know. But really what it's about is a battle for the public opinion about GMOs generally.
Yeah, it sounds like you think that that would be a bad thing if we accept this apple.
Well, you know, my overarching thing in this book is that people should think a little more deeply about the way they eat. Wendell Berry, who's a writer that I'm sure many of your listeners know about, is a writer and a farmer in Kentucky, and he has a great line that says, eating is an agricultural act. In other words, the way you eat directly impacts the way that farmers grow food and the way that we all think about our land. And eating a GMO apple, while it might sit on your counter and not brown for an extra hour or an extra 2 hours, who knows, that is not really the way we should be thinking about the food that we put in our bodies or the way we grow our land. We should be becoming much more intimate with the way that we treat our land. Our land is dramatically compromised right now. We've had soil depletion. Our fresh water supplies are disappearing. We're dousing our land with chemicals, all in the name of eating in this kind of industrial way. We really should be getting away from that and let farmers do what they always did, which is take care of their land in the most sustainable way, feed us the most nutritious food they can, have local economies grow back up again instead of feeding this corporate centralized food system, which is not doing anybody any good. So the apple, to me, is just a metaphor for lots of other things that I think are much more important than that.
Tyler in Oshkosh is with us. Hi, Tyler.
Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Morning.
I'd just like to bring up a little side subject. It's not a side subject, but I work from the spring through the fall at various farmers markets. The farm which I work for, we do grow GMO corn. We also grow non-GMO corn. And I constantly encounter from the retail side at farmers markets this kind of strange paradox. People will come up and ask, is this organic? Does this have pesticides, herbicides on? And for certain days when we're picking, you know, a non-GMO crop, they'll see a worm and all of a sudden just like run screaming from it. They have this conception that you can get just absolutely perfect food. And
yeah, so we want perfect food. We don't want bruises. We don't want worms, but we also want it to be organic. We have just a minute before a news break. McKay, what about that?
Can I just say I'm so grateful for that question. I think that is really to the very heart of it, and it goes to what I was saying earlier. We have become so detached from the way our food is made that, I mean, I have students. I take students out to the farm, and they think that potatoes grow on trees.
Oh, no.
They've never seen a potato. All they know is the potatoes show up in a bag of potato chips. Now, if that's the case, if you think a potato shows up in a bag of chips, what difference would it make to you how it was grown? It wouldn't, because you don't care. All you care about is the bag. If you see a worm in your corn and you freak out, it's because you're unaware that corn is also attractive to worms. That worm is not going to hurt you. Would you rather have a worm that you flick off the corn cob, or would you rather have that corn be saturated in, you know, petrochemical pesticides? I mean, in other words, the worm is visible and non-threatening, or shouldn't be threatening. The invisible pesticides, you don't see them, but they are actually a much greater concern.
Yeah, let me jump in because we have news next, and then we'll talk more about food fights after this news. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and how they are present in a lot of the foods that we can buy at the supermarket. Our guest is McKay Jenkins. He is the author of Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. And we're welcoming your questions for him and your views about GMOs. Do you accept them or reject them? What are your concerns? How much do you know about the foods you eat and whether they have been genetically modified or not? Our guest says that asking, are they safe, is not necessarily the best question, that for the most part, they have been found safe for human consumption. But however, he says that they bring up a much broader issue in terms of the sustainability of our food system. And much more, the health of our environment. Michael in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Michael.
Hi. First off, I hope that you have an opportunity to get a guest on it.
We have, Michael. Go ahead.
That talks specifically about bee colony collapse, because he's misrepresenting the facts on that issue. But what I wanted to say is that the issue around genetically modified organisms is a very complex story that needs to be talked about with more detail than the kind of broad brush we're getting right now. For example, GMOs, when you look at the risks associated with GMOs, you first have to identify what the hazards are. The hazards related to a genetically modified organism that expresses the appropriate protection against glyphosate herbicide is not the same hazard as a GMO, which expresses the protein that comes in every organic gardener's toolbox, the BT protein, which protects against certain types of insects.
Yeah, Michael, I'm sorry. Let me ask you to kind of relate this to everybody listening. What does that mean?
Well, what that means is that the risks associated with a Roundup Ready corn plant or a soybean plant is not the same risk as a genetically modified organism, which is expressing, for example, there's a rice that was developed in collaboration with the World Health Organization that is fighting to prevent blindness by expressing vitamin A in rice, where vitamin A is not a natural component of rice.
Thank you very much for bringing that up, Michael. I know, McKay, that you do address that that particular food and the benefit of a GMO that might prevent blindness.
Well, your caller is absolutely correct, and I want to reassure him and anybody else who shares his opinion that my book actually does exactly what he suggests, which is teases apart all of these different threads. It is not fair or useful to paint all GMOs with one broad brush. He's exactly right that GMOs that are designed to withstand toxic herbicides are not the same as GMOs that are designed to use a naturally occurring insecticide like BT, and they are not the same as those used to create drought-resistant cassava in Africa, or, as he mentions, what's called golden rice, this product that they're trying to release to introduce beta-carotene into the diets of lots of developing children in the developing world. There are hundreds of thousands of children that are born into places that are vitamin A deficient, and they will end up dying or being blind. And so this is a gigantic global health concern, and the question has always been, how do you deliver vitamin A to kids that don't get vitamin A in their diet? Now, unfortunately, or I don't guess that's not the right word, the golden rice effort has been underway for, I think, about 17 years now, and the golden rice has still not been widely released. And even though it seems to be of benefit to people, the cultures that are being asked to adopt this golden rice don't want it. And the reason they don't want it is, as we were talking about earlier, is they are very suspicious of GMOs. And the reason for that is they're very suspicious of American and European companies coming in and telling them what to eat. Now, what's kind of ironic about this is that it might actually be that golden rice is beneficial to them. But even though it might be beneficial, they still resist, not because of the the nutrition, but because of the culture around these products. So your caller is exactly right. This is a very complicated thing. And I just would recommend that everybody who thinks they have an opinion about GMOs consider the complexity of it, because it's really much more interesting and complicated than they might realize.
Yeah. And we have done numerous shows on bee colony collapse and what's happening to our bee populations. He seems to think that you're misrepresenting the GMO or pesticide threat to the bees. Can you do you want to comment on that?
I'm not sure I understood that part of it. I know at least in Maryland, the target insecticide that they are going after are these things called neonicotinoid pesticides, which are made by a company in Germany called Bayer, the same company that makes aspirin, and they are illegal in Germany. In fact, they are illegal in Europe, but they have been used in the United States for some time, and there is a lot of concern that those are causing this bee colony collapse. Now, whether those are directly connected to GMOs is a good question, but the fact is that these insecticides are held up as a primary culprit in bee colony collapse, and I think, generally speaking, I think people should be much more concerned about these poisons that we've become very used to, because we don't understand all the ways in which they're designed to kill insects. Now, they may kill bad insects, but they also kill beneficial insects. This is the reason that the monarchs are collapsing, too. They were not intended to kill monarchs, but they killed the food supply for monarchs. These neonic insecticides were not intended to kill bees, but they do kill bees. So this is just this confirms my general point, which is these introductions of technology into a very complex ecosystem can have all kinds of unintended consequences. That's my major point of caution, is just to realize that human beings can use very blunt instruments and not realize the way that these things will manifest downstream.
Let's take another call. John in Madison is with us. Hello, John.
Hi. Linked to the last person, the last caller's questions is my central question. Two, actually. Have any GMOs been withdrawn because of adverse human health effects? And secondly, we're told all the time that this chemical or this medical drug are safe, and then after they've been in the population, things develop. And I'm just wondering, with the introduction of the GMOs, have any new allergies been noted, any carcinogenic effects, teratogenicity, et cetera?
Thank you for that question. The first part was, have any been withdrawn because of human health consequences? And as far as I know, the answer is no. But to complicate that, I would tell you also that a number of scientists that I interviewed say, as I think I mentioned earlier, that it's just too new. To do a really thorough scientific exam on the effect of foods or things introduced to the human diet takes some time, more time than we've really had. So I interviewed a number of scientists who say that really broad-scale, long-term studies of human health consequences essentially have not been done. I mean, a lot of the testing that's been done has been done on the impact of GMOs on the health of animals. So that's one thing to say. The second thing is, have these things caused any allergies, or is there any carcinogenicity? And the answer there, again, is, I think, yet to be determined. I mean, most people who support GMOs say, we are absolutely convinced that GMOs do not cause health problems. But the dissenting scientists say, we're not so sure. One scientist I interviewed said, a lot of us have these GI problems, like I mentioned, celiac or maybe gluten intolerance or other kinds of allergies, and we don't know what they are. We dismiss them as it must be an allergy to the food. But the question is, what part of the food are we responding to? And since these GMOs in most of the food that most Americans eat, again, the processed food, the sodas, the fast food, that's the place where you find GMOs, not in the fresh produce aisle. If you're eating that kind of food and you develop some kind of allergy or some kind of distress, how can you be sure that it's not coming from the GMOs? This is the state of the science on that part of it is still developing, and I think it's worth remembering that it's still pretty early in the game in terms of testing the impact of these on our daily diets.
And again, this was quite some time ago, and I don't know if it was a hypothetical or if a company actually did something like this, like put a fish gene in a taco shell, and then there, the concern was that that was going, you know, that was just an example that if you have an allergy to X, if that's put into a food that you don't know about, you're going to get sick.
Well, I know what you're talking about. The one that I'm familiar one with was when there was an introduction of a gene from, I think, a Brazil nut. It was some kind of a nut gene that got introduced into a food that was released, and people got very concerned about that. Again, it was never the intention to cause a ripple, but again, the human digestive system is subtle and complex, just like the ecosystem. So you introduce something, and then it runs through its course and has an impact in ways that you can't predict.
Yeah. So we just have a couple of minutes to go. What's a concerned shopper to do when we're at the supermarket if we want to avoid GMOs?
Well, let me try to answer that in a thorough way. I don't want listeners, and certainly not the readers of this book, to think that I am somehow, like, in a blanket kind of way against GMOs. I really am not. The technology is just, as scientists and farmers alike will say, it's just a tool. The question is, can this tool be used in a way that is sustainable? The goal really here is sustainable, nutritious food. So can you grow it with less environmental impact, and can you grow food that is better for people to eat? Right now, this is no secret, most Americans eat pretty poorly. They eat high-calorie, low-nutrition food that is grown by giant corporate farms that are very far away from where they live. My recommendation is don't be freaked out about GMOs as such, but consider the way that GMOs play into the way you eat generally. And the best way to eat, if possible, is to eat food that is grown near where you live and preferably by farmers that you have some kind of contact with. And for my money, organically. It would be really good to have less chemicals in our bodies and in our landscape. And if you find that's difficult, if you find that there are not enough farmers to feed you, that actually is something to think about. In the last 60 or 70 years, the United States has lost 4 million family farms. 4 million family farms disappeared because we built suburbs on top of all these old farms. That has caused a gigantic change in the way Americans eat. Now most of our food is grown and produced out of about 2 or 3 different grains. It's turned into a lot of soda pop and fast food hamburgers and, you know, corn chips, which is what most people eat, which is why we have a national obesity epidemic. We're grossly overweight. We don't eat nutritious food. We have corporate control of our food. All of these things.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to jump in. So fresh and local is a good way to go.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Thanks very much for being with us. McKay Jenkins, author of Food Fight.